You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beej, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we'll be discussing the non-technical characteristics of good developers. We'll discuss why it may not be your technical skills that are keeping you from getting a job. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
I have been rocking out, not really doing a lot of .NET.
Really?
Yeah, I did a bunch of front-end stuff in Knockout.js. You know, so it's like mostly JavaScript. And then I immediately went and did a bunch of work in Delphi.
Wow.
Yeah, so I added to a DLL that we have internally and, you know, got it where I could take a page out of a PDF and render it as a PNG and did that all in, you know, unmanaged code and then, you know, linked it in to pull through .NET. But like .NET was like a real small segment of the pipe.
Oh, wow.
It was mostly, cool. It was JavaScript and Delphi with a big wad of SQL behind the Delphi because of, you know, how we have to get the documents. And so that was fun. That was the first like real thing I'd done in Delphi. And it was surprisingly straightforward. I won't say it was easy because, you know, you got all the memory management issues, but, you know, I had a lot of fun with it. Of course, you know, I used to do VB. You know, we all know that Visual Basic kind of nicked a lot of stuff from Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Delphi had nicked a lot of stuff from Pascal and they were a lot of the same things. So,
oh, neat.
Yeah. So that really, really helped.
I remember when I was right before I stopped messing around with coding, I would start learning VB and it was right after I'd learned Pascal.
I just realized how much I enjoyed that though. For 2 or 3 days there, man, I was just stoked. I was absolutely fried when I got home though, because, you know, you learn a new language, that's the way that goes. And we'll eventually have a podcast episode about learning a new language or learning a second language. The other thing I've been working on is a continuous integration environment at work. That got prioritized as well. And so I actually have a .NET project that's one of our service projects. Got it in the CI system. You know, I've got it triggering builds when somebody makes a source control change. You know, pulls it down, does the NuGet package restore, builds it. There's a DLL in there that is shared with other stuff. So it rolls it up in a NuGet package and puts it in a package repository that we're going to use. And that's been fun. It's not been as fun as the Delphi stuff. It's been a lot of, it's almost sysadmin stuff. But so how about you?
Well, this isn't in my notes, but talking about learning some new stuff, I have been just today messing around with some Angular material design.
Yeah, and you know, yesterday you worked on your acrobatic skills. I heard about that.
Yeah. Oh, I got to get some more work done on my bike now. I used to work at a place that had their company picnic. And so I decided, you know, hey, I just got this new front tire on my bike. I'm going to ride it out to the park and go to the picnic because they invited me. And on the way there, I hit a rather deep pothole, one that was hidden by the car in front of me. Not that I was really like riding up on his bumper or anything, but we were going slow and he had stopped to turn and I was slowing down to stop behind him. And then he turned. Watching him, I went ahead and, you know, hit the gas right into, I saw it and it was about as close as I am to you.
Yeah.
And there's just no way to avoid it. I avoided the worst of it. So I didn't get thrown over top of the bike.
Yeah.
But, the bike went one way and I went the other. I didn't get hurt. Actually, it's kind of funny. I landed on my feet because the way the bike hit, it bounced me up in the air and I landed running down the side of the embankment on the side of the road.
I wish they had a video of that. We could like make one of those Thug Life videos. Yeah. You know, like Photoshop the glasses and the doobie.
Yeah. Needless to say, I was not happy. I took my helmet off and threw it on the ground and said some choice words at the bike and the pothole. And people came up and thought I had flown off the bike and lost my helmet in the fall.
And then they talked to you and figured that you probably didn't wear a helmet.
Yeah.
No? Sorry. Oh, man. So back to the material design. What you been doing?
Well, today I've been working on just popping up an alert and Yeah, it probably would have gone a lot smoother had I already known material design. It would have taken probably about half the day to do all the work that I had that took me all day. It was funny. At one point, I think you and I were texting back and forth, and I got up and walked away just because I was like stuck.
Yeah.
And I came back about 10, 15 minutes later just walking around, and I had this crazy idea. I'm like, well, I'm going to just try it because nothing else is working.
And it worked.
It worked. It worked perfectly first time. I'm like, I spent probably 2 or 3 hours.
Did it creep you out?
Yeah.
Like, does it creep you out when your code works the first time?
Yeah. Well, that happened to me the other day in .NET where I said something was going to take probably about 3 or 4 hours. Because I figured, you know, I'd write it and then I'd have to make it work. And I wrote it and it worked the first time.
Yeah, that just throws me for a loop every time it happens. Yeah. I don't deal well with that at all.
Yeah, one of the other guys was like, well, it's working. Why are you still frustrated with it? I'm like, because it worked the first time.
Yeah, it's like, don't you understand? I'm terrible.
Yeah.
I've had that discussion many times with He Who Shall Not Be Named, and he's got the same thing going. You know, when it works on the first shot, he's like, then I did something wrong, and I just don't know what it is.
Well, I found it later in the day last week when I was working on something else and realized that when you passed a null into it, then it blew up.
Ah.
Because
that's what nulls do.
Yes. Yeah. But with that said, let's go ahead and roll the music. This week for IoTs, I have something that at first had me very excited, and then I read into it and realized it wasn't as interesting as I thought, but still pretty cool little project. This is an IoT coffee pot, and as Will has stated in previous episodes, I do have an obsession with coffee. So this was created by Kurt Clothier. The project measures the weight of the coffee pot to determine when it is low, and sends a notification so someone will come and refill the pot. And it uses a regular kitchen scale to publish the data to the internet. Then when it reaches a certain weight, it sends a notification that the pot is low and more coffee needs to be made. Also, it allows for people who are on their way into the office to see if the coffee pot is empty and stop and get coffee on the way. So for this, you need a digital kitchen scale, LCD, reader circuit, wires, resistors, capacitors, all that fun stuff. It uses PubNub for data streaming, and you can find the source code on GitHub.
Be neat if you could get a little robotic arm that could actually change out the coffee filter and everything and just like make another pot.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool. So who's talking to us?
Well, we actually don't have anybody. That said, if you'd like a CDP swag bag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or on any of our social media. We post all of our episodes to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+. And just, comment in one of those places and get the swag bag out to you.
So what are the non-technical characteristics of a good software developer? Or I guess, why are we talking about this?
I know a lot of developers, obviously. Yes, you do. And one thing that I've noticed with a pretty substantial subset of them is that they think it's only about their skills, their actual technical chops, what I can do with a compiler. And, while skills are critical, a lot of the time the problems you're actually trying to solve that you're getting paid to fix are not in the code.
That's very true.
A lot of times the code is an example of it or is a symptom rather than a cause. And so this is kind of a way to get to the distal causes of software dysfunction versus the proximate causes.
Use some medical terms for me.
I did.
Yeah,
I whipped out the medical.
All right. So the first that Will has listed here is lack of fear using the existing code.
Yeah. And we all like to build new stuff. That's true of me as well. It's a whole lot more fun to build something new and not be building on somebody else's mistakes, rather than trying to fix an old one. Like, for instance, it's even more fun to build a new house than it is to try to repair one that's, you know, 50 years old. Just because you don't know what corners aren't square, you know, you don't know. You have that same kind of thing in a code base.
The thing is, though, already built and tested code is an asset for a company.
Yeah, even if it's not built the way you want it to be. Oftentimes, especially if it isn't built the way you want it to be, because it makes it fast and, you know, it's stable, all the bugs are fixed. You know, that's a productive asset that they now own. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, with all, you know, warts and all, it has value. Whereas development costs are an expense. You want to be not on the expense side of that thing.
Yeah. And also, if you're not willing to work on existing code, you're cheap to replace with someone who will.
Yeah. It really limits your ability to do well on the market.
I know I found the project I'm working on at work is new, and most of the stuff I'm doing is new, but there was already some work done on it before I started. And that helped me a lot because...
Well, it gave you patterns.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something else that might help for a mindset shift. Instead of looking at the old code and going, hey, this has technical debt, this has problems, look at the technical debt and problems as a bit of a lattice of constraints that make what you're doing more difficult and thus more challenging. So it shows how much better you are if you can pull it off. Shift your perspective on that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because that's how I get through it. Every time. Because this is the worst one for me, is because I would rather just throw it all away and start over.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I know a lot of people that are like that. I know I've looked at a few things and thought, I've looked at stuff that I've done months later and thought, I just want to throw this away and start over.
Yeah, it's like if we nuke it from orbit in 10,000 years, it'll be habitable.
Yeah, exactly.
If we start today, that's, that's a big thing. The next one, and this is something I look for in interviews, is the willingness to say, I don't know.
Yeah, now this is something that that I've talked to a few other junior developers that are in the process of going out for interviews and stuff like that. And I explained to them that one of the goals of the interview is to ask you questions and see how you respond to not knowing something.
Yeah.
It's more to see how you handle that than to see how much you know. But on that, you don't want to say, oh, I don't know, to the first question.
Right. Well, I mean, you want to know some things. Like, you got to prove that you know some stuff.
Yeah.
But developers, especially like right as you get started, we have a tendency to have a lot of experience being the smartest person in the room. And a lot of that kind of seeps into personality.
Well, let me just say that...
If you're the smartest person in the room, you're either wrong or you're in the wrong room.
Well, I was just going to say a great way to get over feeling like the smartest person in the room is go to med school.
Yeah. Do anything difficult and you'll be over that, which more experienced seasoned developers have done that. Mm-hmm. And that's why they do better. A lot of this stuff is ways to signal that you have a level of experience. No. It's based on signaling behavior, but less qualified developers tend to go, oh, I don't have an answer for something, so I'll make something up. And better interviewers will catch that, and you're not going to get in. You know, the thing is like when you're green at this, you don't realize that you're not supposed to know everything because it's now too broad of a subject to know everything.
And one thing, too, that a few interviewers have told me that they were looking for, I say, was not that I knew everything, but that I could tell them how I'd find out.
Yes.
So mentioning things like Stack Overflow,
Google,
and other resources.
You'd be surprised how often Google doesn't come up when people mention things. They just go, "Well, I don't know how I'd find that out." It's like, what's the first page when you open Chrome? That's a good place. Of course, the thing is then you'll occasionally get these developers that are like crazy smart. And I interviewed one, I helped interview one over when I was at Brookdale. I think he may still be there. And we were trying to get him to the point of saying, I don't know. The trouble is he knew. And, you know, he had a lot of, I mean, I was asking just, you know, crazy minutiae.
Uh-huh.
And I think I finally got him on something. And he's like, well, I don't know that. We're like, whew. By the way, we don't ever do that. was just, we wanted to see if you'd say, I don't know, and you passed that. It's like, okay, cool. You know? But that's, you know, that's a personality test kind of thing.
Yeah. That really is. I remember when I was interviewing for the job I have, you know, it was a very lighthearted interview because I went in and talked about podcasting with my boss, and he was really cool. And he put me in a, you know, relaxed mood just from the introductory conversation. And then he could start asking me about coding stuff. And it was more like you and I talking than anything else.
Yeah.
And when he asked about something, I think I said, I'm like, you know, I haven't done a lot with that. Like, I'm willing to learn it. It's interesting, but it's just something that hasn't come across, you know, on the stuff that I've done yet.
Yeah. Well, and where I'm working now, he who shall not be named, yeah, absolutely just raked me over the coals during the interview. Like, he just kept ratcheting the difficulty level up, you know, and I got through it, but I was there going, man, he's really lighting me up. And apparently some of the ones that were in there previously didn't do very well. And so that, you know, that interview worked out really well because, hey, I passed that test.
Yeah.
Now, the next thing is, and this goes back to, you know, this kind of fits with point number one, but it's a little different. It actually is a kind of a blend of point number one and point number two. And that's a willingness to rework code, even your own. I said greenfield code, you know, new stuff is, that's what greenfield means. It's more fun than brownfield code. I don't know why they picked that. Because it's like, you know, you would think, like, it's somebody that has no experience with agriculture, because the field's brown, you're about to plant something. And if it's green, there's something already there. So it should be the reverse. Like, that just completely throws me. You're
thinking agriculture? I read this and I think sports. A green field is a fresh field. A brown field is one that's been played on.
Okay. I can go with that analogy. But this one, I always hated that way of putting things, because I'm like, that's not how it works. What kind of crazy city people came up with this? Now, reworking code is difficult because it requires that you test things. You know, you follow good practices. You can't spitball and throw things out there and go, oh, well, it's going to come out in testing because we've got this long cycle before it's done. Mm-hmm. It's like we're breaking things that are running right now. You know, you have to understand the code that's there to be able to change it, even if it's written in a way that you would never think to do things. And man, I've seen some stuff. But this makes it harder.
When you're writing new code, you're not supposed to, like, try and make it so that the testing doesn't find anything?
Well, it requires attention to detail, but it doesn't require as much, right? Because, like, let's say you're starting on a brand new project. Okay, well, what's testing going to do? They're going to test all the things, and it's going to get hit over and over and over as you're moving through. So it's easier to sneak by without appropriate testing.
Also, with something that's already established, it's been through testing and it's been through user testing.
And your testers are used to testing it, and so they do things in a methodical way, the same way, yeah, every time. They've got habits. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to introduce breaking changes there when you wouldn't have done it if it was new code.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the other thing is, you know, reworking your own code requires humility as well, because it essentially requires that you admit that the code wasn't perfect the first time.
I know what you're talking about. Always write code perfect the first time.
Yeah. No, really. I mean, I'm always freaked out when it works the first time.
Yeah, we were just talking
I just get up and go walk somewhere because I'm like, there's something I'm missing and I need to figure out what.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that willingness, that humility is important, you know, for proving that you have the capability to do what you say you can do.
Next is being willing to try out new concepts. Being stuck on a certain way of doing things means that not only is your career as a developer limited, but so is the team that you're working on and with.
Yeah, and let me explain what I mean by this. When you're a senior developer or a team lead, there's a lot of conversations that happen behind closed doors that I think a lot of junior developers are not aware of. And one of those conversations is, if we do this, can the team actually do it? Can the entire team do it?
That's management.
Yeah. Or is somebody going to get hosed? You know, if it's going to hose two out of the five developers that you have, you're not going to do it. It doesn't matter if it's better, because it's very expensive to hire a new developer. It's not really all that nice to let somebody go. It's disruptive. It makes, you know, it kills morale. It's, you know, you don't want to be doing that. So the conversation comes up as, okay, can we survive doing this? Can we get the team to the point where they can do it? Is the team willing to do it, or are they going to push back? And so you have to have that willingness, because if you don't, you're the boat anchor that's slowing the whole team down. And economies go up and down. You do not want to be that person.
Being able to quickly pivot to better ways of doing things. Notice we didn't say different. Can allow a developer to make the entire team more efficient.
Yeah. Because, you know, conversely, if you bring something in that goes, hey, I can save everybody time on this one thing and make it easier to do, all of a sudden now you're adding value.
Mm-hmm.
It's the appropriate application of new resources. I had a, not my side project, but on the project I did before that, we had a couple of former PHP programmers that were kind of green, and they were running this project, and they never met a database connection that they didn't leak. I wrote a code generation framework for that wrapped it, made it easier for them to talk to the database without leaking a connection than it was for them to go and leak the connection the way they normally did. And, you know, because I was able to leverage a different way of doing things, I was a net gain to the team. And that's, you know, that's pretty huge.
I think one of the things that really helped me get the job that I have now is, while primarily a .NET programmer, I can do front end and JavaScript and Angular.
Yeah.
So when we're working on a sprint, I come in and I do the .NET stuff. And when I finish with that, I move over and I help out with the UI.
Yeah. And especially being flexible really helps.
Yeah. I say, especially because a lot of times the UI team is waiting on the API stuff that I'm working on to get done to focus on that part of the story. And so I can move over and help out with that and understand the whole flow. And we've got one of the, our front end lead, he's learning C# now so that he can do that on the reverse.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, there's people on the team that can cross back and forth. And for him, who's, you know, been there for 3 or 4 years as a front end developer, this is him being able to try out new concepts and quickly pivot.
Yes. Well, you know, where I'm working, you know, being able to pivot and do the Delphi stuff, that's getting me more praise than I deserve on that. But, you know, whatever. But my first job out of college was kind of the same deal, too, because I was half technical writer and half web developer. But because I could do the technical writing and I could switch between the two, they had hired another guy like a week after me who was a developer. He got downsized. I didn't. And it's because they were like, well, for one thing, it's complicated to downsize somebody out of two departments.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's like harder on the people that are making the decision. And then, you know, somebody comes in a week later and, you know, and his skills were also better than mine at that point. Yeah. But being able to do that
was very helpful. It's one of those things that, you know, not just knowing and being able to do multiple things, but being able to make those changes and to recognize when, hey, this is a change for the better and get on board with it.
Yeah.
Rather than resisting change for its own sake, which is the next point.
Yeah. And, you know, resisting change for its own sake is another thing, because you do want to resist cases where things are getting changed for no good reason. Like if there's no upside,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the app I'm working on right now is all web forms. Well, somebody could come in and go, oh, you need to rewrite that as ASP.NET MVC or ASP.NET Core MVC, or you need to do, you know, something else. But we already have a running app. Like, that change provides no value to customers. It provides no value to management, but it makes developers happy, right?
Yeah.
That's not a change I'm going to sign off on, because I'm aware of, hey, these are the constraints here. This is not, besides the fact that it would require our entire team to retool. You know, out of the three ASP.NET developers there, I'm the one with the most MVC experience. You know, that's not a good way to set things up.
Yeah. Even if they wanted to do MVC because, you know, the developers wanted it, not having that experience could be...
Yeah, it would slow everything down. Yeah. It kills all the releases. A good developer is not going to change something that is working and stable just to use the newest technology. A bad developer will be loudly advocating for that. In fact, we had somebody there a while before me who did exactly that. They wanted to throw everything out, rewrite from scratch, you know, scorch the earth, etc. And that doesn't really fly with management. Like, that person did not last very long. And still have a very bad, bad reputation there as a result of that. The other thing is, like, you know, like we said before, bleeding edge risky technology might or might not help the team. But what you want to do is actually evaluate whether it will before you implement it. Because until you actually know what the risks and stuff are, you should not be making that decision. You know, it's seasoned experience teaches you not to do risky things quickly without evaluating.
And on that same note, a good developer recognizes that there is a cost to that change and a cost to the uncertainty of that.
Yeah, because it's like, okay, well, how long is it going to take us to do this? Well, I don't know. It's new technology. This is one of the places you don't say, I don't know. Like you can say that to other developers, other tech people. When you say it to marketing and go, oh, well, we don't know when this thing's going to be ready. And it could be any time in the next, I don't know, 4 years. No. They can't sell that. You know, unless they want to sell vaporware, which is what happens a lot. But that's not good for the environment that you're in. So, you know, be aware of that. Like, don't change just to change.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of hit on the next one a little bit about talking with marketing, and that is the ability to communicate. Most development shops have more than one person in them.
If you have just one person, you have clients.
Yeah. Usually the developer is not the product owner.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Which basically means the developer has to be able to communicate well. And this includes written communication. And we even have episodes on writing technical documentation and face-to-face communication. Our very first episode was on talking tech with non-developers. We've also had ones on non-verbal communication. You know, we've got a lot of stuff about communication because it is so key to being a good developer. Something we haven't talked about is phone communication.
Yeah, and that's a subset of face-to-face or a subset of the skills for face-to-face. I know a lot of developers that when they pick up the phone, they sound irritated immediately. And it's like, okay, I get that you just got interrupted, but if it's a client, that doesn't really fly.
Yeah, some people, though, even if they're in a great mood and they're happy to talk to you, sound irritated when they're on the phone. I'm one of those people.
Yeah, I am too.
People call me and...
I'm actually one of the people that's always irritated if I have to answer the phone.
Well, like, it could be, you know, my little sister or my nephew. Yeah, they're calling me and my sister says, did we call you at a bad time? Are you mad? I'm like, no, I'm happy to talk to you. Yeah, it's just... a lot of the time when I'm on the phone, it comes off that way. And a lot of times it can be trying to maximize the economy of conversation.
Yeah.
That causes that. And this also includes not only not sounding irritated, but not coming across as cocky or condescending.
Yeah. And, you know, I've worked with quite a few developers that were just not very good at that. I've also worked with quite a few that seem to think that the accuracy of conversation is measured in decibels.
Yeah, I know a few of those.
Yeah, and they just get louder, you know, as their points get refuted. It's like, oh, well, this just solves, you know, let's just get louder and louder and louder. And that doesn't come across well because then you look like an idiot defending your position.
See, when I have conversations with people like that, they get quieter and more forceful.
Yeah.
That really throws them off because they don't know what to do because I'm not backing down, but I'm talking a lot quieter and more thoughtful. And they just don't know what to do about that.
Yeah.
But then again, I like to mess with people, so.
That's a lot of fun. Yeah. But the cocky and condescending thing will absolutely wreck your day, especially during an interview.
Oh, yeah.
Because nobody wants to deal with that. They're not hiring you unless, mm-hmm. you have to have, Steve Jobs plus level skills to get in somewhere with that attitude. Like the way that he is recorded as talking to people and acting towards people, you have to be way up to get away with that kind of crap.
Yeah, you really do.
And you're not.
Not if you're listening to this show, for sure.
Well, it's not even that. It's more of a thing of, look, you know, even if you were, what if you were a decent human being and you were at that skill level?
You could get so much more done.
Yeah, because you're not going to make everybody hate you.
Yeah. Well, this is where the next point of having reasonable social skills and outside interests come in. Mostly the social skills and what we were talking about, but outside interests are important too.
Well, those facilitate the social skills, right?
They really do.
People that only write code, like they go to work, they write code, they go home and they fiddle around with computers and they write code and you know, like they're extremely dull people. I've known a few of them.
I'm looking at one.
No, you're not.
I'm just joking, man.
I do lots of other stuff.
I know. I'm there for some of it.
Yeah. But I mean, it is really dull. And, you know, the thing is that doesn't mean that you skimp on your technical skills and say, oh, well, I'm going to make it up with personality, because I've also known those kind of developers. And the thing is like, if you think you're doing that, you're really not.
No, because I have a lot of personality, and I know just from having a job now, there is no way I could get by on just my personality.
Right. Well, the best way to think about it is personality for a developer is like cruise control for a car. If the car doesn't drive, the cruise control doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. You know, that's a better way to put it. But it is kind of expected on modern cars.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be able to do that.
What it does mean is that you have a broad enough range of experience to actually be able to relate to people and be pleasant to interact with when you do so. You know, I mean, be able to hold a conversation at lunch with your coworkers that doesn't involve what you're doing in the job.
Yeah. And honestly, a lot of really nerdy topics kind of do the same thing too. You know, the thing is, if you're not interesting, people are not going to be interested in some way. And you don't have to really do anything really crazy. It's just, you got to have something outside of work. And honestly, a lot of really, really nerdy things can get you by in a lot of places. But if the only thing you can talk about is like anime or something, you need to probably broaden your scope a little bit, because you also have to have something going that somebody that's not a techie can talk to you about. Like, that's how people establish rapport.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, well, I'll tell you guys a funny thing. So I mentioned going to my previous job's company picnic. Well, I met one of the coworkers that was friends there, her boyfriend. Ran into him today in the hall at work. Not only do we both work at the same place, we work two rows over from each other.
Yeah.
And he's not even a developer. He's like, does something completely different. But, you know,
it's a small world.
It is. It is. Another kind of brief story. Friday, after I'd gone Thursday night to see Suicide Squad, you know, I mentioned it to one of my coworkers, who seems kind of like someone who would enjoy something like that. And he's like, you know, I just have no desire to see that movie. It's like, I really don't have a desire to see most movies, and just not a movie buff.
Huh.
Never would have guessed it, because he's kind of nerdy in some things. You know, we get to talk, and of course, we've gone to lunch two or three times, and we're becoming friends, but we got to talking, and he's big into paintball and stuff like that. And it's just like, oh, I can talk to you about this. I don't really do much paintball anymore, but...
Yeah, but having the awareness of that.
Yeah.
And that really comes down to you know, the last little bit of that is that if you're working with somebody and you don't have anything in common, like that's the symptom of a problem. You know, either you're missing something, which, you know, it means you don't know enough about this person, you're in the wrong place, or more likely you're ignoring commonalities that you should be paying attention to.
Something that I personally set out to do is find things that I have in common with people, because it makes talking to them easier.
Yeah.
And if I don't know something about someone, I know back, it was after college, I think it was in grad school, I dated a girl and she was really big into anime. I'm not.
Yeah.
Never have been. Just not a thing that I enjoy. Some people do. That's cool. Well, my friends that introduced me to her, they were like, oh, well, here, before you go out with her on the first date, let me, you know, kind of catch you up on stuff so you'll have stuff to talk about. I'm like, no, don't. I don't want to know, because then I can ask her and that'll be a conversation.
Yeah.
So even if there are people that have vastly different, you know, interests, but where having social skills comes in is, even if you're not interested in that, being able to talk about it by asking them questions and getting them to talk about it, then they'll want to know about things you're interested in.
Yeah. And you might find out that it's a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just being able to bridge that gap is pretty huge.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you human instead of some dude in a cubicle down, you know,
yeah,
down the row.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
The next one is the ability to own up to mistakes. You know, the thing is you're going to screw up and take down a server at some point. Like, that happens. And you might as well be prepared for that. Like, don't have the mindset that, oh, I'll never screw up and I'll never do anything like that. Unless you only work in environments that are like triple checked, you know, to make sure that nobody screws up ever. And that, you know, like that's not a thing. If you can't admit that you caused a problem when you caused the problem, not only are you incapable of avoiding it in the future, but anybody with any sense is incapable of believing that you're going to try to avoid it in the future.
I got one for this. This is funny because this was a mistake that I didn't know I'd made, but ended up taking down the entire testing environment. Because we just, like I said, we're working on a brand new product. So we just, in the last sprint, set up like a separate test server and everything for it. Well, we set up a separate test database. This is about halfway through testing. I was going in and doing some refactoring and stuff on the dev side. And I realized, oh, hey, I need to make sure that I don't accidentally commit or publish to the testing environment. So I went in to set that up so that I wouldn't accidentally set the testing environment to connect to the wrong database.
Yeah.
And apparently that had already happened. And when I went in to set it up to where it wouldn't happen, I fixed the problem.
Yep.
But in the testing environment, they were using that data. And so I completely blew up all the testing. And I didn't know I'd done it. So when one of our lead developers came up to me and asked, you know, hey, did you do something with the testing environment? I was like, no, you know, all I've been doing is doing some refactoring and stuff in the dev environment. And like he said, well, here's what's going on. I'm like, well, that's not supposed to be in that database. Like, I knew the data wasn't supposed to be there. I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, here's what happened.
Yeah.
And so I explained what I was doing. I'm like, I didn't think I published to it, but I might have while I was doing, you know, while I was making changes so that this wouldn't happen. Of course, he kind of chuckled. He's like, well, hang on, I got to go explain to him.
That it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. What's going on? So he went and he talked to him, and then he came back, and one of the other front-end developers, they came over and, I felt terrible about it. I really did. And they came over and shared their stories about the first time they broke something.
Yeah.
And we all went and got a cup of coffee and just sat around and talked about that kind of stuff. But, you know, once I found out, yeah, that was me that did that, I said, hey.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I took responsibility for it. And instead of getting in trouble, you know, we went and had coffee and they told me stories about when they broke stuff the first, you know, during their first few weeks.
Yeah, I've broken a lot of things. And the ability to own up to it and go, okay, that was a screw up. Because, you know, if it takes a server down, even if it's the right thing, it's still not the right thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you need an outage window for that. You can't just go, oh, yeah, sure, just nuke the fridge. It's fine. You know, that doesn't work. And, you know, I've done that, good grief, dozens of times. And, you know, I've also had, you know, systems that I've designed for one purpose, but I didn't write the documentation well and somebody kind of bent it a little bit for another purpose, and it fell over at scale.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, like I had a system that was basically sending messages on a message queue. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well, a scheduled task is just a message that's deferred in the future. Well, that's great until somebody goes, oh, well, I can defer messages for everything, you know, for millions of the things. Man. And then the scheduling database just, you know, it just falls over and dies. I mean, it just, and all of a sudden production's down.
Yeah.
And you can't replicate the problem in dev because it's a scaling problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, look, you know, I wrote the documentation like an idiot. I didn't say, hey, yo, dog, don't do this much.
Yeah.
You know, I should have made that, you know, the way that it's scheduled, I could have made that more robust, but I didn't think about that use case. And that was my fault that the thing fell over.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes if you're not the one that.
Yeah. This was six months after I left.
Yeah.
And that brings up the, you know, well, the thing is you, if you're really good at making bad mistakes, typically you're not only bad at recognizing them, but you're also really bad at recognizing that others think these things are mistakes.
No.
And I had a conversation with somebody that did some bull in a china shop maneuvers, you know, at a previous place, and they not only did not realize that they had done that, but they were proud of what they did.
I know, because, people like that.
Yeah, because they thought it took guts. And it's like, dude, you just lit your house on fire. Like, don't be proud of your scout skills at, you know, starting to spark with flint and steel if you did it in the living room. You know, it's
yeah.
That's not a win. And it's not something you really want to be doing. But there's a lot of people like that. And the big one that comes out here is attention to detail, because this is usually how these things manifest. There's a lot of developers that are really good at getting a lot of work done for basic use cases of a system. And they absolutely fall flat when it comes to edge cases, error conditions. Like, people don't test what happens when an error occurs. And especially when you start getting into like distributed systems or really complicated processing, that will come back and bite you regularly. So, you know, having the attention to detail and actually thinking about those things is pretty much key for actually being a good developer, simply because if you don't do that, you're going to get interrupted by problems so often that you can't be a good developer, even if you're the smartest person that ever lived.
But yeah, because you can't focus.
Yeah. And it's just like, at that point, no amount of intellect or studying is going to help you. So, like, don't put yourself, you know, in a position where you have no leverage. You know, the thing is, you just really can't be a good developer without paying attention to small details. Small details, you know, one-off cases, edge cases, those things, if they're taken care of automatically, that's a great way to add value to a system that you're developing. Small details being ignored, however, is a great way to add cost. It's like, okay, I have a system that, you know, automates 80% of, you know, some workflow. Mm-hmm. But the other 20%, it increases the cost of by 5x. Guess what? Your system's a negative because they paid for the system and they still have the same workload.
Mm-hmm. Just a slightly different workload. It's probably more tedious and
more unexpected because they don't know how much worse is coming.
Yeah.
Because it's also the perception of the thing. Now your system's buggy, even though it gets rid of 80% of the work. You don't want to do that. And if you're a good developer, you're going to have enough attention to detail to mitigate that. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but
yeah.
You know, that makes it a whole lot easier to mitigate it and to catch things before they really explode.
Yeah, that makes sense. But finally, the ability to blend in. You should be able and willing to write code that matches the standards where you work.
Yeah.
And this kind of goes back to working with existing code, because if you're writing brand new code, it's a little bit different. There's a little more leeway there.
Yeah.
So far as this is concerned, but a lot of us end up working in areas where we're working with existing code.
And you really just want to leave no footprints.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody opens the code, they shouldn't know, and you're new, they shouldn't know whether you wrote it or whether the guy that has been here 5 years wrote it, because it should have the same naming conventions, the same structure, even if you think they're dumb, because most people's naming conventions are interesting at best.
Well, I know mine are really dumb, but I like them that way.
Yeah. And, you know, you'll evolve those over time. And that's, you know, the team kind of evolves stuff like that over time. Like, you really want to stick with conventions so that other people can reason about your code. Because the ability to make assumptions and make projections about the way things work is how you get civilization. Yeah. Now, this goes out a little bit further, because in general, you should generally not stand out in a negative manner. You know, it's fine to stand out in ways that matter, but you've got to do it intentionally. So, like, don't be the loudest person in the office. That has no value. You know, don't be the one with the messiest workspace. Like, don't be identifiable by a negative trait. It's just not worth it.
If you are really working in a true geek dev shop, you will not be identifiable by having Doctor Who stuff.
Right.
Because several other people will.
Well, and there'll be people that are, you know, dorkier than you in some way.
Yeah.
And honestly, you could, you know, in that kind of environment, you could be stand out by having a desk that's too clean.
Yeah.
Too. Like, don't deviate so far outside the norm. And I know people go, oh, but I want to be an individual. It's like, they're not paying you to be an individual. They're paying you to get stuff done. And when you keep getting noticed, and if it's not something positive, you get remembered when unpositive things have to happen.
I got noticed today by my boss's boss.
Was it the dress?
Sorry. Yeah, well, you know. it's the shade of blue. It really brings out the brown in my eyes.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, it was my boss's boss was walking by, and she was introducing somebody new. And she's like, oh, this is BJ. He used to be the new guy.
Yeah.
And she looked at the shirt I'm wearing, which is a shirt from there.
Yeah.
And she's like, he used to be the new guy, but as you can see, we've already assimilated him.
Yeah. It's just better not to be noticed on stuff that sticks out. And the other thing, and I hate to bring this up because I know somebody that needs to listen to this that isn't listening. That means avoiding touchy subjects that are inappropriate for work. This is especially bad when it's you're working with people that you've known outside of that environment, or you're non-professionally associated in some manner. You know, touchy subjects are things that are divisive. So you want to avoid religion, politics, and a lot of stuff that it's easy to tell yourself are not either of those two things, but actually are. So like discussions of morality, social justice, like doing all that kind of stuff, because you alienate people. The thing is that it's not whether you're right or wrong. It's the fact that you know to be a good developer, to actually be able to produce, you have to not tick people off all the time. Mm-hmm. You don't pick fights over useless crap that brings you no value. And that's what those things are. Because, I mean, go to your Facebook page and scroll down and find an argument that is just, you know, inflammatory that you disagree with, and then let it convince you. Because you're going to have a hard time with that. Nobody ever convinces anybody with this stuff when it comes up and it's divisive and inflammatory. It just doesn't happen. But it will erode your team. And if, especially in an interview, if people see that in you, or if they see it on your public social media, you're not going to get hired.
Yeah, that's
especially if it's different than what management would look at things. You know, it's one thing if you're, you know, like for instance, the social justice angle, right? Most companies that are like older and established companies, that's not really the core of their thing. And, you know, the people that are higher up are going to be alienated by that. Now, there's companies that you can do that, and that's fine, and that's where you want to go. That's cool. Like, if it's a place where you go and there's no debate on that, go ahead.
This comes back to kind of having social skills.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to kind of feel out the company and stuff. But if you bring up a subject and it leads to arguments,
yeah,
especially with people above you,
yeah,
that is when you go, you know what? This is something to discuss on my own time, away from the office, where it's not going to disrupt the work that is getting done here, because I'm not getting paid to argue these things.
Right. And it's not just a lack of pay, but it's like, look, this is putting wedges between me and other people that I have to work with to reach a goal that has nothing to do with this. It's a misallocation of value, and it's the sort of things that gets you noticed at the worst possible time, because it's like, hey, we've got to let two people go. Well, there's that one guy down there that
annoys most of the people that work here and is rude and
stands out as being, you know, extremely messy, extremely loud, whatever. Like, you don't want to be the nail sticking up when the guy with a hammer comes around. Don't do that. That's just dumb. And once you've been at this a little while, you realize, hey, this isn't worth it. And that tends to be a mark of somebody that's matured enough to realize, hey, you know, I don't want any part of this. The thing is being a source of division offers you no power. That being a source of unity and a leader, right? Like there's no upside to it compared to doing the things you should be doing. And it takes away options.
I guess the whole point here is humans are tribal beings, and, you know, ignore that at your own peril.
Yeah. And you realize that people have markers for what constitutes being a member of a tribe. And if you stray too far from those, they'll allow variation, but just in general, a group of people, they don't want people going way outside the norm. That's just not, not the way it works.
Exactly. That pretty much wraps us up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about social signals, in particular, signaling behavior. Let's say that you have an environment where you're evaluating every employee. Employees can choose whether to take the evaluation or not. What kind of employee doesn't take the evaluation? Well, the employee that doesn't take the evaluation typically is going to be the worst employee, because if there's a gain, they're going to go for it. If there's not a gain, they're probably not. So what happens? Well, people eventually develop the mindset that, hey, not taking this evaluation signals that you're a bad employee. In other words, it signals that you have access to a variable that they don't, and it's a proxy for that variable. And this is kind of a weird thing, because as you get into social groups, you'll discover that the weighting of these things is quite different, depending on what the group acts like. You know, Beej actually probably can jump in on this signaling behavior thing. Is when you're in a group, there are behaviors and characteristics that define that group.
Yes.
And there's almost a code talk in just about any group that you get into. And if you know the right words and you know the way to put things, people realize that you're a member of the in-group instead of the out-group.
Well, that's something we've talked about with design patterns. Is a lot of the term, a lot of the concepts aren't difficult. It's the terms that once you know them, you're in the clique. In the group. A very outward expression of this would be organizations like fraternities and sororities or secret societies,
which usually never are secret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like the Masons and stuff, where you have rituals and you learn certain phrases and things like that. I know most fraternities, their Greek letters actually stand for something, which is a closely held secret by most of them. I was in SAE, and that stands for the Sleep and Eat Club. I'm just kidding. No, that was just a joke that some other fraternities made about us that we just kind of kept. But yeah, it's there are those things, and then there are things that are almost like inside jokes or shared experiences.
Yeah, or experiences that are very common.
Yeah.
Like when we talk about, like the running joke of Java being slow.
Yeah.
Like you can make that joke with another developer and they get that you're a developer making that joke, even though, the JVM, they've kind of cleaned that problem up.
Yeah.
To a large degree. Like that's not really a thing now, but everybody still gets the joke. It's the inside joke that matters. And being able to feel those things out and know enough of the lingo to where you actually fit is a good idea. Now, in addition to the whole signaling behavior thing, right? Signaling says, okay, I'm in the in-group or the out-group. A lot of people love to signal that they're in the out-group because they feel like they're rebels without a cause, and they want to be different. Well, what happens? Well, there's two kinds of out-groups. There's the near out-group and the far out-group. People get really mad at the near out-group because it's, hey, here's somebody that mostly accepts what I believe, but they differ very slightly. An example of that is if you look at somebody that's from a vastly different culture, right? Like take a Southern Baptist preacher or a Church of Christ preacher. They're going to get mad at the other denomination. But a Shinto priest is exotic. That's just two completely different things. And a whole lot of people like to send most of the social signals that they're supposed to send, but change a few things. It's like, this does not help you. You either have to be so far out there that you're exotic, and even then you're going to tick off a lot of people.
What I've noticed is it's not so much that they purposefully do that. It's that they want to be that exotic.
Yeah.
But they don't go all the way to being that exotic. They're
unmotivated. They're slackers. Yeah.
They're unmotivated. They're slackers, or they go as far out as they're comfortable going.
Yeah. Because they want attention. And, doing that, well, it's like you're marking yourself as an outsider. And the only time that that's actually valuable is when being an outsider is valuable. Being very slightly off the mean is not valuable because it makes you look like, well, here's somebody that just, that's a loose cannon on our side.
Yeah.
And people come down a whole lot harder on their own side than they do on people that are way out. But it's just important to remember this little characteristic of human interaction, because yes, we're tribal, but tribal has got a few boundaries, because you can be an outsider inside the tribe, and that person gets it worse than an actual outsider. And so just bear in mind that dynamic, because that's not a direct correlation.
Yeah.
On fitting in. So that's what I've got. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit psychological, but it's sort of important to bring up. If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.